Welcome back to another episode of the Exterminatus Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Eric, and this week, Ray has been laid low. So with me, I'm bringing my special issue ammunition in the form of a guest host. Welcome, Don Hoosen, to the show.
Hey, guys.
Yes, he's back. Hey, first of all, congratulations. 14th currently in the ITC. How's that feel?
It's good. I need to get back up to top 10, though.
So everyone's been asking me ever since the rule of three came out on the FAQ, you know, how upset is Don and is he muttering into his cornflakes every morning? And I was trying to tell him, well, you tell him, what are you doing with your time right now?
Putting together all my other armies that I had set for when the Storm was going to get nerfed. It was not surprising to me that it was going to get nerfed. I was hoping it would. I hope for a different way, but it is what it is.
So, and I've seen some of these lists. Be warned, he's going to be in the top 10 very soon. So, yeah, no need to cry for Don. He's going to be stomping on your throat anytime soon. So, we've got lots to talk about, Don. Over the past weekend, we had Warhammer Fest, which normally has kind of been a snooze fest in the past, but a bit of a surprise announcements over the weekend. And we've been leaked already by the Warhammer Communicate, as well as some nefarious sources on the internet, have shown us the latest and greatest for the Harlequin Codex. We might even talk a little Death Watch in between there, too. So let's get started with Warhammer Fest. Hey, Don, have you ever been to Games Day before?
I have not.
Okay. See, I did. And I have to say, it was both the exhilarating and painstakingly disappointing event of all time. It's like going to Disney World and half the rides being broken. So give you an idea what happened. So first of all, the first time I went, I was in spectacle of the, you know, they had a narrative game going where they had, you know, Titans. And it's like the first time you've ever seen a Titan in real, you know, right in front of you. It was just amazing. And then they had these display tables. They're like you see in White Dwarf. They're not actually being played. They're meant to look like a battle scene. They had like easily a dozen of them. I mean, some of them, like one of them had like 11 Eldar flyers and stuff like that. You're just like, this is just amazing. And then they had the big tournament going on and all the little seminars, which were a lot of fun. But a thing that drove me nuts was the Necron Codex was coming out in 3 weeks. They even gave out t-shirts called The Sleeper Awakens. Did they have a preview copy? Nope. Any pictures of the new models? Nope. They didn't even acknowledge that the Codex should be coming out soon. They wouldn't even confirm the release date. And I was like, this is ridiculous. Why? You've got a stadium in Baltimore filled with your fans. Why would you miss this opportunity? It just blew my mind. So fast forward to 2018, Games Workshop actually did a live blog, minute by minute, of what's going on at Warhammer Fest with all the new releases. And they came out with a truckload of stuff. So a lot of it was that the big announcements really were for Age of Sigmar. By the way, second edition's coming out. I was kind of surprised. The first one just came out. Feels like last week. But some really neat stuff also for 40K. So let's get into that right off the bat. First thing we can find off is she's plastic, she's beautiful, and she's on the t-shirt I got the last Games Day I went to. A plastic Sisters of Battle 3D render. Don, did you have a chance to see this?
I did, and I was sad at first because I thought it looked exactly like Finecast, but 3D renders do that. But it looks pretty good so far. I'm excited to see if they do the rest of the range that well.
It's pretty stunning. So if you remember, I think it was two editions ago, they started doing the more realistic artwork. And there's a Sister of Battle, kind of like, she's got the, not quite the as sharp of the bob haircut and the whatnot. So they show her next to this 3D render. And I have to admit that cinematic base is pretty cool as well. And it's amazing how much detail is on there. Now, is it realistic? Heck no. You don't make armor in the shape of corsets. It's a great way to direct blades towards your heart for a critical hit. But it looks really, really cool. She's got like these candelabras on her base and then some more gothic arches lying around everywhere. Yeah, if the rest of the line looks like this, these things will fly off the shelves. These things look amazing. Now, unfortunately, there were no hints at rules or release date or anything else like that. So all we got was a nice picture of the plastic sister, but it looks pretty amazing. So it's something to look forward to. Two new factions for Age of Sigmar. I say the same thing I always say when Age of Sigmar models come out. Lots of conversion bait. I'm seriously looking at, they have this new ghost faction. I don't even know what they're called. Night Haunt.
Yep.
I'm thinking about converting them all into make a Inari army of all these spirits. I think it looks pretty cool. Other fun stuff that came out. Long-awaited Adeptus Mechanicus. This is another one that was kind of a gut punch to me. I was like, finally, because this is actually the game that got me into 40K. I played Space Marine first and then became Epic. And then finally says, you should play with the bigger models. I'm like, what bigger models? Ooh, those are cool. So they're bringing it back. And then they have this little tagline at the bottom. It's based off the Horus Heresy. Oh. But it's interesting, they do have two size Titans, and apparently the Realm of Battle tiles that you can get from Forge World, those 2 foot by 2 foot things, they're coming out with four of those to scale for this new game to play on. And they had some demo games at the game. It does look really cool. It's just, Horus Heresy. Not my thing. More stuff for Blood Bowl, more stuff for Necromunda. So blah, blah, blah. I'm starting to fall asleep. And then I go, what is that? That's right, folks. Necrons, because, you know, they're a very underpowered, weak army, weakest codex in the game right now. They needed some help, right, Don?
Of course.
They're getting a new super heavy from Forge World. Picture a Triox Stalker the size of an Imperial Knight.
I have a thing that looks kind of like a bowling ball, because that's probably what it's going to do. Curl up into a ball and roll forward.
And roll. And you know, it does a little look like the destroyers from the prequel Star Wars movies. It does look like that. It's pretty funny. But yeah, it's got these two very large legs in front, very similar to like a praying mantis. And then the other four legs in the back are significantly smaller. The head's in between the two legs. And then he's got these two large weapons on the side that come out on the other side of the legs in the front. Didn't really give us a lot in the way of what this thing does. It's simply a Imperial Knight size crawler that looks like an ambitious cryptic decided to build a tomb spider as large as a Tesseract vault. So it does look pretty well. I think the side views makes it a little less of a bowling ball. You can actually fit a Space Marine underneath it comfortably. It's one of the sizes they show there. So I thought that was rather interesting.
Just imagine trying to charge within an inch of that thing.
Yeah, that's always the problem with these leg gear models. The Defiler is another one, the Soul Grinder, those type of models. It's like, okay, where's the inch? Where do I measure from? It's always a bit of an issue. They redid, I can't tell if this is for 40K or Horus Heresy, but they redid the Dreadnought drop pod, so they can actually fit a Contemptor Dreadnought inside that.
That's for both.
That's for both. I was afraid of that. It's the last thing I need is a Contemptor Dreadnought in my backline. And then on the Talons of the Emperor, looks like they are fleshing out the rest of the Custodes and Sisters of Silence through Forge World models. Now, this again, I'm not sure if this was Horus Heresy or both, but my guess is they'll find a way to make it both.
Yeah, with what they've been doing with the Custodes stuff, the giant dreadnoughts and their vehicles, whatnot, it's probably going to work its way over to 40K, but I do believe that is 30K only right now.
So keep that in mind. Custodes are already pretty popular. Sister Silence could use a little boost, and I think that might be the boost they might need. Other big surprise for me. Hey, did you know they're still making models for The Hobbit? I had no idea. But and then finally, Games Workshop also displayed some new merch, some all kinds of stuff, including a pretty rockin' hoodie there, and that looks pretty cool. So neat stuff coming out from Warhammer Fest. I think, let me ask you, Don, of the stuff that we saw, what's got you the most curious?
So of all things that I've seen from the releases, oddly enough, the thing that has me the most curious is this Mechanicum Knight Acastus. Is a gigantic Adeptus Mechanicus-looking knight that as they put it, what if you combine the Acastus Knight Preferidon with even more barely understood horrifying techno weaponry from the Age of Darkness? And that thing looks massive.
It does look massive. It's when I had to admit the first few times I looked at it, I was like, oh, that's for the Titanicus in a game. I was like, nope, that's for 40K Endor Horus Heresy. That's pretty big. Looks a lot like the Profirion tank. But then you look at it, it's like a little bit different. So, yeah, not sure what to make of that thing. That is pretty gross. So, and I think it's probably the most Mechanicus looking as opposed to Knight Household than we've seen of the other knights.
Yep. Almost looks like it has two giant conversion beamers on it.
Yeah, that's probably what those look like. But it's got, it looks like it's got like the saw blade design and its shoulder pads. And it doesn't look like it has a carapace weapon, though. No, it doesn't.
Well, it has there's like a Volkite gun of some sort under its left shoulder where the heavy stubber normally is.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Oh, well spotted. Okay. So we'll see that, and that's what always concerns me when they see these things come out for 30K. It's just a matter of time before they convert them to 40K as well. So I'm a little nervous about that. I have to say, I'm a little curious just to see what they do with Age of Sigmar. Because let's be honest, when we first heard about the current edition of 40K, we used to refer to it as a Sigmarization of 40K. What is in the minds of the game's designers, and could this be foreshadowing future changes for 40K? So I'm curious to see what they do differently in Age of Sigmar, because all they said was the typical, we're streamlining, we're making the gameplay more exciting, blah, 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 but didn't really give a whole lot of specifics. So
I will definitely say as well, one of the things that they came out with this stuff was, I know you were talking about the Night Haunts earlier, but the Age of Sigmar, they took all the people that said you need to put women into 40K, and they ran with it hard with the Sigmarines. And they all actually look really, really good. It's not, your stereotypical medieval girl that wears a chainmail bikini. These look like mostly what you'd expect, someone that actually was trying to keep themselves from getting stabbed in the chest to wear. It looks amazing.
They do look really good. They really do. And just well sculpted, and they're the same way. They look more realistic, but they also stand out. But again, it's not the typical 70s heavy metal magazine look. So also interesting to see more female characters in some of the newer factions as well. And we saw that with Daughters of Cain, although that's kind of the more classic look. But even the Undersea guys, I forgot what they're called already, but it's quite enough. Something like that. A lot of female characters in there as well. So it's good to see it. So be curious as things move around. Still looking, waiting for that Xenos character to come out that's not humanoid. I think that'll be pretty cool someday. But so that's pretty much the what's new from Warhammer Fest. After the break, Don and I are going to dig into what's new with Harlequins right after this.
Are you a gamer that has more bare plastic than you have time to paint? Do paintbrushes spontaneously combust when you hold them? If either of these is true, contact White Crow Studios and get your models painted by a college-trained professional painter. You can contact Bo at whitecrow.commissions@gmail.com and view his previously painted models at White Crow Studios on Facebook.
Okay, and we are back. So one of the things that's already been befuddling the mysterious ways of the Harlequins is, when is this book coming out? So allegedly, according to White Dwarf, it's supposed to be this weekend. But I don't know, Don, have you seen any pre-orders gone up yet?
I have not. I know that Warhammer community has been starting up their, hype train. But normally you'd expect the week and before, Saturday before, that it gets put up on their site for pre-orders. And I have not seen that. I just remember seeing a little blurb in a White Dwarf that said they're coming out on the 19th. So don't know what's going on with that. Must be Sigarach playing a trick.
Must be. So be prepared for that. Keep your eyes open. In the meantime, though, the Warhammer team and the community page, as Don mentioned, have started up the hype train, and they are not pulling any punches on days one and two. They actually started Sunday night with a little bit of a teaser about the Webway portal. But since then, we've gotten some more news about the Webway portal. So we're going to skip the speculation, get right to the meat stuff later on. In the meantime, though, to this morning, they did talk about the mask forms, which are basically the Harlequin version of chapter tactics. So you choose one of these forms, and that gives you your detachment special ability du jour. So the first one that came up was the Midnight Sorrow. This is your typical Harlequins. This is the red and blue checkered patterns with black suits. And all their units with this form gain an additional D6 when they fall back. In addition, units with this form consolidate up to 6 inches. So, Don, how would you use this?
So, the good thing with the falling back an additional D6 is basically like getting an advance when you fall back. Except for you don't suffer the penalties for advancing, even though Harlequins don't care about that at all. But the good thing with consolidating up to 6 inches is that you can grab more things and pull them in so that your Harlequins are not getting shot up. Harlequins love to be in combat. They don't like being on the receiving end of bolters.
I think the first thing, when you think of fallback, it's always you kind of have to change your mindset about you have to go in reverse. You can fall back in pretty much any direction, especially because Harlequins ignore intervening models and terrain. So they could actually fall back towards another enemy or even just to another location. There's a lot of things they can do with this. It's just pretty amazing.
Yeah, and especially with this trait in particular, none of your opponent's characters will ever be safe.
I didn't think of it that way. Yikes. That's kind of scary. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, they can charge and fall back in the same turn, correct?
And shoot.
Was it just... And shoot. Okay. I know they can advance and charge in the same turn, but they can also fall back. Okay. So, yeah. So, basically, you're advancing out of close combat to attack someone else, which can be, yeah, character, other tanks as the second wave comes in. Ugh. It's gross. All right. So, be aware of that. Next one on the list is the Veiled Path. These are the green and yellow guys. And they get a nifty ability called Riddlesmiths. So, which means is they... At the start of each fight phase, roll two dice and discard the highest result. Until the end of the phase, each time your opponent targets a unit with this form and makes a hit roll that before modifiers exactly matches your dice result, that hit roll fails. So how would we put that to best use?
So this one I like as a overall type of close combat type of Harlequin thing, which... I say close combat Harlequins, that's all that Harlequins are. But the best part about this is it helps keep your Harlequins alive longer in that fight phase. So like say that you were like a 3 and a 5, you get rid of the 5, and the 3 is still there. Everyone that normally would hit on a 3, which is also the unmodified dice roll. So like say they get like +2 to hit, and they roll a 3 on the dice, that also goes away. It's the exact same type of wording that the rule of rolling ones has, where if you roll a 1, no matter what your modifier is, you can have +16 to it. You miss. The same with this. You roll a 1 or a 3, it's gone. Or say that you roll boxcars, 1 or a 6, it's gone.
So one of the things, yeah, because you're discarding the lowest, you're going to have to roll boxcars to get rid of that 6, but discarding still... discarding high, excuse me. Said that backwards. Yeah, so the characters, they get the extra attacks on sixes to hits and all the other exploding sixes results. They're still in play. But remember, you're paying a premium for those characters that are hitting on twos, hitting on threes, you know, coming in. And you can easily take that advantage away. So now you're actually making your opponent's army overcosted for what they do. And because you can mix it up and around, it's more than just a -1 to hit. It's because it's always a... It's a variable number, but it's also the way it affects the dice. It's much different, much more effective way of reducing hits back on you. So if they can't hit you, they can't wound you, and you don't have to worry about making armor saves. It's very effective.
So yeah, I think that'll be the most commonly used competitive form. because it's going to keep you on the table longer.
I'm just doing a quick read through one more time at the start, blah, blah, blah. It's all in units, so that includes vehicles as well.
Yep. Yep.
I didn't know.
This is not a Space Marine. This is not a Chaos Space Marine. You're good.
Wow. Did not pick up that the first few times I read that. Moving on to the Frozen Stars. They have Hysterical Fury. This is a real simple one. Plus one attack on the charge. And it lasts until the end of the phase. So I was a little surprised that they didn't get the plus one to charge or be charged. But just a flat plus one charge.
Yep. And I think that was just a fluff thing that they did, because Harlequin should never be getting charged. They're always the chargers. But this is the one that looks like it's for the whole bunch of, you know, troops. And by troops, I don't mean the roll troops, even though that's what they are. That's their actual troop selection is called a troop with me. But yeah, if you run just these guys, it even mentions in here, troops, the players, which are the actual name, like Tactical Marine, the players all have four attacks apiece. This makes them go up to five attacks, and they are fairly cheap for that many attacks hitting on threes. And you can give them special weapons that are pretty crazy. But yeah, just imagine 10 of those guys getting into combat on the turn that you charge. It goes from 40 attacks to 50 attacks.
I mean, it just blender screens easy. And just, it's disgusting. Just the weight of dice will just tear things apart.
Yeah.
And most of those special weapons you talked about earlier are very high AP. So it can easily blend through, you know, Marines, and especially with the Death Watch Codex, everyone's talking about Intercessors and Primaris Marines. Okay, we'll blend right through those too. Next one we have is the Dreaming Shadow. They offer a nifty little ability called the Somber Sentinels. When a unit with this form fails a morale test, only one model from this unit must flee. In addition, each time a model with this form is slain or flees, roll a d6 before removing that model. On a 4+, that model could either shoot with one of its ranged weapons as if it were the shooting phase, or make a single attack as if it were the fight phase.
All right, so this form in particular is one that I think is probably the weakest of them. It's your, you know, Black Templars of the Harlequin Codex. So basically, they have a nice little ability that whenever the unit fails a morale test, only one model flees from the unit. They have a high leadership, so when you fail a leadership test, odds are you've already probably lost the unit, or you're, you know, it's very unlikely that it's going to come into play that often that you need to worry about that. The second part of that is whenever a model is slain or flees, you roll a d6 before removing it. On a 4+, that model can either shoot with its ranged weapon as if it were the shooting phase, or make a single attack as if it were the fight phase. This is very similar to that Space Marine Chapter Ancient, where when a guy dies, he shoots. Except for Harlequins don't have long-range guns. They have little pistols, which most of the time are in the form of shuriken pistols, which they can burn through armor if you roll a 6. Otherwise, it's just a bolt pistol, which, it's okay. The other part is you can make a single attack as it were the fight phase. So when a Harlequin attacks, the part that makes them so powerful, their weapons are normally pretty good, but the part that really makes them powerful is that their basic troops, the players, have 4 attacks apiece. So they weight of dice things down. Having a single attack with a strength 3 dude, it's probably going to hit, it's probably not going to wound, it's probably going to get saved if it does. It's not enough to make this form worth anything compared to all the other forms that there are. And like they even go on to say, bring large units of Harlequins, get them out with deadly pistols, and if someone kills them, they're going to be in there for a nasty surprise. If they're close enough that you're able to shoot your pistols, they're going to back up and just shoot you anyways because they don't want to be close to you. No one wants to be in combat with Harlequin.
Yeah, it was a little lag. At first, it sounds really cool that you get a second attack. I kept thinking of the Noise Marine ability. I was like, oh, that's what they got. But when you actually start thinking it through into practice, you start realizing that, what am I going to use this? Because, I mean, the big difference is, Noise Marines have a long-range shooting. My little pistol, if I'm already that close, then, one extra shot or one attack. Now, if there were a fight again, as if it were the fight phase, and I get all four of my attacks, I'd be, we're having a deal here. Not the case. So,
make Harlequins Wolfen.
Yeah. losing one model max is still pretty cool, but they have a high enough leadership, so it may not be that big a deal. But they are, although they did come down in price, they are expensive enough that I don't want to lose more models than I have to. So I don't know. It's not terrible, but I agree with you. It's probably not the strongest one of the bunch.
Yeah.
All right, last one of the bunch, though, is an interesting one. Silent Shroud, as opposed to a loud cape. I'm not sure what this means. Anyway, Silent Shroud, Dance of the Nightmares Made Flesh. Subtract one from the leadership characteristics of enemy units while they are within 6 inches of enemy units Subtract one from the leadership characteristic of enemy units while within 6 inches of any units from your army with this form. In addition, whenever your opponent makes a morale test for a unit that is within 6 inches of any units from your army with this form, they must roll 2 dice and discard the lowest.
So I actually do like this one, especially when you combo it with things like Death Gestures come to mind immediately. The biggest reason why I say Death Gestures, they have a wonderful little rule that whenever they attack a target in the shooting phase, whether or not they even hit it, whether or not they even killed anything, you basically put a counter on that unit. If it fails a morale test, you, as the person that owns the Death Gesture, can pick which models flee. So that can be like the Demon Banner, that can be the Icons, that can be the Power Fist, that can be their Melta Gun, their Las Cannon, whatever you want it to be, is the thing that goes away. And they have no way to stop that, except for, passing a morale test. And they even go on further here to explain the other parts that you can do on top of it. Like the Homunculus Covens have another aura of reducing leadership. The Hemlock Wraith Fighters have an aura of reducing leadership. So very quickly, just as an innate thing, you can have it so that, you're -4 leadership just before anyone dies. And most of the models in the game do not have crazy high leadership. 8 is a really good leadership. 9 is mostly where our characters are at, but the majority of what you'll see is somewhere between 5 to 7. So when you subtract 4 from that, even killing one dude might make them lose like 4 extra dudes. And when they roll 2 dice taking the highest, or discarding the lowest, so yeah, taking the highest, that makes it so that it's more likely they're going to roll that, 4+ on the dice, or, the higher roll. Less likely to be a 1.
I think that's something let's think of on the more pessimistic end of things, okay? It's most likely not going to be a 1. So your opponent would have to roll snake eyes to only lose one model. So when you think about that, if you're forcing a leadership test, or at this point, start planning ahead. It's just like, okay, where am I going to get, how many models do I need to kill to really force this? And maybe at one point, can I get away with not pouring as much into this unit because the last 2-3 models are going to get picked off because they're going to flee. Having that second die, knowing that you're going to at least lose one model no matter what, assuming that you've killed enough to negate the leadership bonus. So, but now you can start reducing the leadership with all these other gizmos. You mentioned the Homunculus. Don't forget the Hemlock Wraith Fighters, which is also mentioned in the article. It's a great way to really whittle down some of those bigger units, but I like going after elite units. When you start losing a model, it's a 20-point, 30-point model, and you're like, sorry, you just lost 2 for free. Thank you. Very useful, very handy. And when piggybacked the right way, it can be done. And it doesn't, I think when we try to do this in 7th edition, it felt like it was very forced, but this doesn't feel that way.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was just trying to say, so one of the units that I do think is actually going to be very useful now, which I might be getting a little ahead because these are things that I've seen that have not been shown to everyone yet, at least not officially. Death gestures, I do think, are going to be pivotal now to Harlequin armies because of the ability to go, if anyone does flee, you pick, means that it'll be that much easier to try point something to make it so that people can't run away from your Harlequins. Because they're not going to be able to yank that one dude. It's like, oh, I failed a morale test. The guy that's pinned is running away. You're going to be like, no, 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 that guy's staying. The other guys on the outside are running away. So I think death gestures will be a lot more useful than they have been.
The other model I was thinking might be helpful with this, although I still think the death gesture is probably the more useful of the two, is the Spirit Seer, because they had that hallucinogenic grenade launcher, which forced leadership checks, I believe. I'm trying to remember how that worked.
So the Shadow Seer is the Harlequin one. The Spirit Seer is the Wraith construct Eldar guy.
Shadow Seer is what I'm thinking of, yeah.
The Shadow Seer, they have a hallucinogen grenade launcher, which is like a 18 or 24 inch range grenade that it might be assault. Either way, what it does is all you have to do is hit with it. And then what you do is you roll, I saw the two or three dice, I think it's two dice. And if you beat your target's leadership, they take D3 mortal wounds, which can work really, really well when, you know, you're surrounding it with a whole bunch of negative leadership buffs or debuffs.
Yeah, it's kind of like the old Silent Shriek. I remember it worked something similar to that, but it's pretty nasty stuff. So pretty good mix, mix and match. I think we touched on how to take advantage from what we know what's in the book of what how to make the most out of these particular forms. However, we did come across some news that's not in the book. So, in fact, some of the stratagems have been leaked onto the internet. You can find them probably at your favorite rumor monger. So some of the stratagems as well as rules for the Webway portal. And so without further ado, I'm trying to find the article.
All the ado.
With much ado and pomp and circumstances. Brought to you by your sponsor. Come on, there it is. I found it. Never fails.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun. That's the Webway. Point values. All right, so we're going to start with point values and get in stratagems, or how do you want to do this?
Give me just one sec. I was just grabbing that paper that had my alterations on there. I was like, yay, my little cheat sheet.
Yes, very handy. So, yeah, so on the internet, a gentleman has apparently got a copy, or it could be a woman, I guess, has a copy of the Harlequin Codex, and he's taken, or she, we don't know the perpetrator of such information, has released pictures, not of everything, but of some interesting pieces, mostly stratagems, point values, as well as the data slate for the new Webway portal. So let's start with the points cost here. A couple things went up, a couple things went down. Overall, pretty positive as we've seen with any Codex release. But Don, you've got it all broken down for us.
Yep. So the main parts, just going through HQs, through dedicated transports, the main parts are the only guy that went up was the Troop Master. He went up 11 points with the kit that I had him at, which was a Fusion Blaster and a Cress, which those are unchanged points-wise. So 11 points, he's 70 points now base. Which I think is actually a good thing. I think he was a little too strong when he was like 59 or whatever cost he was before. Then we have the Shadow Weaver, the caster. She went down 9 points with her standard kit. The troops, the players in each of the troops, which are their basic dudes, went down technically 3 points apiece. They all went down 2 points apiece, and the basic equipment for them used to cost 1 point apiece. The Harlequin Blade, that did nothing, except for count as a weapon. And now the thing costs 0 points. So effectively, the base Harlequin troop went down 3 points. The other equipment still costs roughly the same, but by and large, that will drop the cost of your army by quite a fair bit. As far as elites go, the Solitaire dropped 12 points. He's now below 100 points. I'm hoping to see what else happens because of him, but we'll see. The Death Gesture, he became so much cheaper. I'm so happy. I think he started off with like 75 points in the index, dropped down to 60 points in Chapter Proved, and now he's 45 points with the Codex, which means that I might actually not feel bad about bringing him out, because as I've preached so many times, being able to pick who fails the morale test, rather who leaves because of a failed morale test, is essential in keeping your melee units alive, because that allows you to keep whoever's pinned, pinned. The Skyweaver jet bikes, they went down 10 points apiece, with the Zephyr Glaive and the Shuriken Cannon kit out, which I think is going to be the most common way you'll see those guys. So that means that the Hologram bikes also feel like they got the much-needed points decrease, because while they are amazing, they did cost 56 points apiece before, which is really expensive for a Toughness 4 bike. And then as far as both the Void Weaver and the Star Weaver, the two vehicles, their points changes are completely zero. So that is the points change between all of those. I know the Kiss also went down a couple points, down to the same cost as a Caress now, but I think everything else is roughly the same.
Looking over, you know, it's kind of, we talked a little bit about a couple mixing matches. I mean, one of the key units that really stands out with these point reductions are their jet bikes. Before, they were just cost prohibitive. Now you're thinking that we're going to see them back on the table?
Oh, I definitely do, especially with the alteration to turn one reserves, because these bikes are really fast. They move 16, automatic 6 when they advance. Because the Harlequins, they can advance and charge. They also have those assault shuriken cans on the bottom. But basically, this means that you're going 22 inches with that bike squad. With between 6 of them, there's 18 wounds in there. So you're going 22 inches before you charge. You can add on top of that, assuming that their psychic powers don't change too much, there's a psychic power that's basically like warp time. Allows you to make a friendly Harlequin unit move again. So that 22 inches becomes 44 inches, lets them get into whatever in the backfield they need to stop. Like, say you have an artillery battery, say you have a character brick, anything at all like that, you can literally just shut that down with one squad of bikes.
You mentioned with that ridiculously long move being 22 inches, No Man's Land's usually only 24, so after moving and advancing, with no variability on the advance, but mind you, you're looking at a 2-inch charge.
Yes.
So that comes kind of handy, especially with the Zephyr Glaives. I believe Zephyr Glaive went down in price as well, and that's their damage to close combat weapon on those bikes.
Yep. Currently, it's plus 1 strength, minus 2 AP, 2 damage. So it makes them strength 4. But they still have 3 attacks apiece, so not as many attacks as the basic troops, but they are a lot more durable because they're toughness 4. They still have the 4-plus invul save. They still have minus 1 to hit against them in the shooting phase, which, when you get the stratagems, there's a fun thing you can do with that.
Let's talk about some of that. So the first stratagem coming to mind is the Silken Knife. This is specifically for the Silent Shroud folks. Now, I mentioned starting with them because we kind of bashed their chapter tactic, but use a stratagem at the start of the charge phase. Select a Silent Shroud unit from your army. Enemy units cannot fire Overwatch against that unit in this phase.
And that one I actually really do like. That's probably the biggest factor that'll make that one actually usable, is the fact that you can basically have that one unit that flies way up forward. This will probably be on a bike unit, by the way, because it can move so far, so fast, and it can cover a lot of area. And you're just going to charge everything and lock everything down.
Paramite.
It's also fairly...
Those bikes are big, that too. They're a little bigger than your standard Eldar jet bike. So, yeah, they...
I want to say they're on Dreadnought bases, roughly.
Roughly, yeah. They're
the Venom bases. That's the best way I can put it. Venom bases is what they're on.
So, yeah, looking at it, they did get cut off, but it looks like they still have lightning fast reactions, which is very similar to the typical that the Eldar have been getting. You get shot at, play this, and this one interesting. It says subtract. I think it's subtract one. I'm not sure, but.
Yeah, so subtract one from the hit rolls. That's what I was talking about would work really well with their innate Mirage launchers. Because then during the shooting phase, you have a -2 to shoot at you with that unit that you flew way across the table at, you know, 44 inches down before charging. And say everyone backs up and tries to shoot you to death. You go, well, I'm -2 to hit now. Have fun dealing with those 18 wounds. Good day. Yeah.
So in case you've forgotten, pretty much every Harlequin vehicle has a -1 to be hit. So to start with wit. And don't believe there's any range. It's not just beyond 12 inches. I think it's just being shot at in general, correct?
Correct. It's a shooting in general. And there's one other thing that's going to go hand-in-hand with that, which is the next stratagem I like to talk about. Prismatic Blur.
Yes.
Which is the stratagem that got put in with Chapter Approved. Works really well with that same little technique I'm talking about, where you're advancing, going 22, doing it again, 44. When you advance with this stratagem, let's see, the exact wording of it is, use the stratagem after a Harlequin unit from your army has advanced. That unit has a 3+ invulnerable save until your next turn. So that's very, very powerful, and the best wording about that is your next turn. It's not until the end of the turn, because then your opponent's turn, they're out in the wind. But until your next turn means that it's both your entire turn, your shooting phase, sight phase, fight phase, morale phase, all that stuff like that, charge phase, and then your opponent's entire turn. And then once it becomes your turn again, then they turn it back to just a 4+ invul save. But that makes it that your that unit's -2 to hit with a 3+ invul save. It's a storm shield bike unit that's really hard to hit. I think it's going to be a very, very potent used thing in at least all the Harlequin armies. And probably you'll find some of those things in place of, well, maybe not in place of, but definitely soaking up the same kind of role as the Samhain, Shining Spears, and the Reaver jet bikes of the Dark Eldar.
Yeah, it's just pretty brutal across the board. And a 3+ invul is so much more reliable than the 4+. It sounds silly, but just it feels that way. And it's just, yeah, pick the right unit, and they're going to do some damage. Any other stratagems, see what you want to bring up?
So let's see. We can always just go through them all, but one of the ones that it sounds really awesome, but I don't know how good it's going to be, is the Hero's Path, which is a callback to the formation from last edition, where use the stratagem at the start of your movement phase if in which a death gesture, a solitaire, and a shadow seer from your army are within 6 inches of each other. Remove all three from the battlefield, and at the end of your movement phase, set them up anywhere on the battlefield more than 9 inches away from the enemy. Which none of those units, except for the solitaire, are suicidal, as I like to put it. And the solitaire can already fly across the table at people and be suicidal. So I don't think you're going to want to use 2 command points for that. Then we have Sigaretch's Jest, which I think this is actually a fun one, especially if you have the fusion pistols, or the jet bikes, which is 1 command point. Use a strategy when an enemy unit falls back from a Harlequin unit from your army. After the unit has finished moving, provided no other enemy units are within 1 inch of your unit, it can shoot the enemy that fell back as if it were the shooting phase. So when someone's trying to back away to, you know, allow them to shoot at you, and you just really, really need to get that kill point, you can just unload for one command point all of your shuriken cannons, all of your little pistols, your prismatic grenades, your fusion pistols, whichever, and just let loose on it.
I think the first unit I thought about this was like destroyer spam lists, because Necron destroyers are, you know, there's so many wounds, that high toughness, and but they're generally small units. They're like units of four, units of six. The idea that, okay, I got one, all right, let's keep pouring it in, would be an ideal target.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Then we go on to the Soaring Spites, which I'm forgetting which one the couple of these are right now. But the Soaring Spites, let's see. Just before Soaring Spite infantry unit consolidates, instead of moving towards the nearest enemy model, the unit can consolidate up to 6 inches towards the nearest Soaring Spite transport from your army. If all models in the unit end within 3 inches of the transport, they can immediately embark upon it. If its capacity is able to hold that many models, as if it were the movement phase, and can do so even if they disembark from the transport in the same turn. This is what I think that you'll see for anyone that likes to do the fusion pistol type thing, because it will allow you to do, you know, hop out of your transport, fusion pistol, charge, slap people a little bit, and consolidate away. Like, even if you're touching the opponent, you can consolidate 6 inches away to try to get next to that transport to get back inside it to protect your fusion pistols for another turn. So that's the way that you can do it if you're running the transports.
And if you remember, the Soaring Spites are the ones that convert all your pistols to assault one weapons. So these two pair very well together.
Yep. Then we have the Dreaming Shadow stratagem, which is an example made. And this one is why you put fusion pistols on your troop masters. So this one is, use a stratagem in your shooting phase. Select a Dreaming Shadow character from your army. Until the end of that phase, each successful hit roll with this model causes 2 hits. Hit rolls of 6+ made with this model cost 3 hits instead. So that one troop master, so long as he hits on his 2+ to hit with that fusion pistol, he's doing at least 2 fusion pistol, you know, melt-a-gun shots, basically. And then if he rolls a 6+, he's doing 3. Another thing that could combine with, well, is if you were doing that on a Shadow Spectre when you're just trying to unload his, Death Gesture, when he's just trying to unload his Shuriken Cannon, or Shrieker Cannon, with a Shuriken Cannon profile to try to eliminate a unit. Because you figure he's got 3 shots, he's sitting on 2s, that's probably going to turn into 6 to 7 shots, or if he's super lucky, it can be up to 9. And those are still Strength 6, they have the Rending Rule, and if someone fails a morale test, you get to pick which one's run away. So that one I do think is actually pretty good thing to do it with. And which Shadow Tactics were those?
Those guys were the ones that if you
The ones I don't like.
Which is funny because you roll 4+, if the guy dies, he gets to shoot again or strike again. Again, focusing more on the, you don't lose more than one model to a morale test. And then you have the stratagem, it's not that bad. There are definitely worse tactics out there.
Yeah, let's see. What are the ones we have here? So we have Skystride.
I like this one. There's another...
All right, Skystride. Which one are these guys?
This is another formation redo.
Soaring Spites, which is... Hold on. Somewhere over here.
Soaring Spites are...
Oh, there we go. The Fly Guys. More of the Fly Guys. Oh, we did go over that one. That one was
get back in boats.
Yep. So let's see. There's that. I think there's another one I'm missing. So there's the one for the Webway.
It's actually portal. Two of them. It's pretty cool.
There are two of them. There's one that's really, really good. if you plan on being extremely aggressive with your Webway Portal and giving your opponent something other than your Webway Portal to shoot. Because that Webway Portal is not super durable. It can die. And it can probably kill off several of your units in the process if you go super heavy into it. But this one is one command point. Use a stratagem when a Webway gate from your army is destroyed, which is the reason why I like the stratagem. Before you remove that model, you can immediately set up one of the Eldari units from your army that has not been set up from the Webway, wholly within 3 inches of the Webway gate, and more than 1 inch away from enemy models. After you've done so, remove the Webway gate from the battlefield as normal.
So real handy, especially that kind of will be back kind of feeling that, I destroyed this Webway portal. Here's 2 command points. I'll make a new one. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
So.
And then the other one, I forgot how many command points it was, but it's another Webway portal one where you can either pull 2 units out of the Webway portal or instead, and the Webway portal is that when you set them up, they come out 3 inches away from the Webway portal and at least 9 inches away from the enemy. Or you can instead pull out one that gets set up. I want to still say it's 3 inches.
3 inches from the portal, but with more than 1 inch away from the enemy model.
Correct. So you can just come out and unload on someone if they're close to your Webway portal. Because otherwise, a Webway portal, if you come out normally, you have to be away from your opponent. Granted, that's a really big model, so it's not hard to do. But if they're surrounding it, that's really, really, really hard to do.
It's an interesting model. I think it's be interesting too. So when obviously the intent is to make it this large gate, like in the picture, it actually is sold as 2 halves. So I'm curious to see what kind of modeling for advantage we're going to have to deal with. But the general way it works is pretty much it's a deep strike point. You deploy within 3 inches anything that's in reserve. Deploy within 3 inches of the gate and more than 9 inches away from an opponent. If the Webway gates are all gone before everybody comes in from reserve, you lose those units, just like a Necron player. If you run out of monoliths and nightsides, the same thing happens to them. It's a little on the brutal side. Toughness 8, 12 wounds, 3 up, 5 up. And it's a 5 up Bidvolt, not a 5 up Feel No Pain. And it is available to all things pointy-eared. So Eldar, anything Eldari is basically what's the only keyword it has. So, but the thing I find very interesting is that you can deploy it anywhere on the table as long as it's 3 inches away from another terrain piece and 12 inches away from your opponent's deployment zone. So you can be very aggressive with this thing and deploy it forward, similar to Nurglings. What Don and I were kind of going over before the show is that a good idea?
So one of the biggest issues with it is it is a nice, big, juicy target, especially when you tell someone I have, you know, this big old brick of like a Eldar Scorpion inside of it. If they kill that, they either have to spend the command point to get it out, or it dies. I can definitely see people bringing more than one of these if they're trying to go for the Webway strike kind of thing. But then also, that first entire battle round, no matter how you try to pull it out, even with that stratagem, if you are not inside your deployment zone because it's being pulled from reserves, it dies. So all that it's 120 points, is a fairly durable unit. I can see it as being a way to protect a Wraith Knight or something like that, but I'm overall not impressed enough with it to want to bring one.
I'm kind of on the fence. It's not the be-all, end-all I was hoping it to be, but it does check a couple of my boxes. One, you can take more than one. I loved the Webway Assault back in the Ulthe Strike Force army list back in forever ago. I do like that you don't have to worry about one thing, for example, with the Webway Assault or Webway Strike stratagem. It can only be infantry, bike, or beast unit for Dark Eldar, and I think just infantry or bikes for Graftworld. It became very restrictive. I missed the being able to bring some of the bigger stuff in. This thing, no restrictions. I mean, you can put I mentioned Wraith Knights, Super Heavies, Large Unit of Talos, you name it, it can come throughout this gate, which is pretty intriguing. But then you start thinking about the actual gameplay, or where am I going to put this on the table? I don't want to do it turn one because I want these things to come out and be able to, you know, further downfield, take advantage of this accelerated movement, take advantage of what it is to get, you know, power from pain on higher levels. Whatever it is at this particular point, that's the hard part. Where do you put this thing on the table to be max effective?
Yeah. And at least as far as I can tell from the rules, it's not like, you know, Nurgle Tree or whatever, where Nurgle Tree becomes neutral after deployment. So this one, as far as I can tell, will hold objectives. So there's something to think about.
I did not think about that. It's fairly tough. You can hold objectives. That's a clever idea. So I don't know. I'm still on the fence about this thing at 120 points. And I think the biggest thing is the detachment slot. So you're going to basically give up one of your detachments and take a fortification network. Correct me if I'm wrong, you're allowed, up to 3 fortifications per detachment? So you can put 3 of these on the table, like, which may be a little bit overkill, but it's interesting. I like it. It's not it's not overly powerful, but I think it's a good tool that it will definitely help with the, you know, Eldar as well as Harlequins, keeping their guys safe by keeping them off the table. So, and I forgot what this thing retails for. It's like $40, I think. Yeah, but I'll tell you one thing. Looks a hell of a lot better than the old sawed off wiffle ball they used to try and sell us. That was do you have a real one? Do you really?
I still have one. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's tin. But
I refused to buy one, so I actually hunted down an old wiffle ball and cut it and tried to make my own. That's pretty funny. You can see all the scuff marks from foul balls and stuff. It's hilarious. So, anything else to share on Harlequins at this point?
Just that I'm excited to see him back on the table. I have several that have been sitting in a box just waiting for a codex, which... I know back when I 8th edition came out, I was using Harlequins a lot. They were a lot of fun. They definitely died. But I do think that all this stuff is good for them.
And actually, if I remember right, your Harlequins were painted by White Crow Studios.
Yeah, they were. And they look beautiful. They're nice, pretty.
So what do you think is the one thing Harlequins need that we haven't seen yet?
I'm curious to see what the psychic powers and whatnot are. Let's see. I think that, at the bottom here, on their official thing, they said they're still getting ready to show all the stratagems, the relics of the psychic powers, and the warlord traits, which I'd have to see how that all comes into play. The hardest thing for Harlequins is they have a hard time attacking units that are on the opposite side of the table from them. They don't have a lot in the ways of long-range shooting. They are fast, but aside from that crazy 44-inch movement jet bike thing, which does require psychic power to go off for that to happen, aside from that, they don't really have a way of going from point A to point B, effectively stopping an opponent from doing something.
They are still pretty fast.
They are still fast,
though. Yeah, we'll have to see what the rest of the week brings in terms of previews from the Warhammer community page, as well as other nefarious sources of information, and whether or not the Codex is actually coming out this Saturday or not. We're still waiting to see. So after our long review here of the Harlequins, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk about the ITC top 10 players, as well as upcoming ITC events for next week. All right, gang, we are back with the updated ITC top 10 players. We've had a little bit of movement since our last week's show. And going through the top 10, falling to 10th place, formerly in 9th place, Jeff in Control Robinson, 151 points off the lead. Tumbling also from 8th place to 9th place is Matthew Ali. He just came off a big win. How did he go down? That's amazing. It doesn't look like it was tabulated yet. Ah, that's why. He is 141 points off the lead and a hefty 9-point lead over Mr. Robinson. Eighth place, formally dropping down one more spot from last week, is Daniel Sansone. He is 131 points off the lead. Interesting enough, he has, of the top 10 players, he's got 5 events, and he is scoring the least amount of points per win. He's only averaging 98 points per event so far in his top 5. That's the lowest among the top 10. In seventh place, also dropping down a slot, is Anthony Bellum. He is 119 points behind the leader. Jessica Bowman drops one slot down as well. She is 115 points off the lead. Another drop from fourth to fifth is Andrew Ford. He's at 108 points off the lead. And then coming in is Bruce Merker, also dropping a spot. He has finished all 5 events, and he is only 75 points behind our leader. So the big mover, so how do all these people move down so far, is TJ Lanigan leaps from outside the top 10 all the way to number 3. It's a long-distance request. 556 points on 5 events, making him only 67 points behind our current leader. In second place, your Adepticon champion, Matt Root, 59 points off the lead. And your number 1 player in the ITC for yet another week, you guessed it, folks, Joshua Death still continues to lead the pack with 623 points. He is actually doing quite well. He's averaging 124 points per event, which is second highest. Interesting, the player with the most points per event is Matt Root at 141 points per event. He has 4 events and 563.92 points in those 4 events. So interesting mix of players. Not some of our more famous players from last year, not quite cracking the top 10. Don, what do you see in these top 10 players that maybe we're missing at this point?
So one of the things I was checking out, Matthew Ali guy, he's the one that did really well at the Alamo. It looks like he actually is put into his scores, but the reason why it's not showing up is because he has 1 major and 5 RTTs. So he has 4 completely missing. And I was actually looking at his stuff, and it looks kind of awesome what he's doing. He has 1 event as Thousand Suns, 1 as Orcs, 1 as Jukari, 1 as Chaos, 1 as Eldari, and 1 as Cabal the Blackheart. So Jukari, Blackheart, same kind of thing, but everything else has been pretty much a different faction every time. So...
yeah, mixing and matching.
I like that. It shows you that you're doing something. Aside from that, I do think that it's kind of interesting how there are only, in the top 10 now, there are only 3 players that have 4 or 5 scores. So I do think that those ones are going to shoot way up in the rankings here in a little bit, assuming that they keep up their strong showings. I'm pretty sure that Matt Root is going to sit on top of first for a while after he does another GT level event, because he's just been crushing it with his showings. He has 1 third place showing and all the rest are first, one of which is one of the biggest events, especially as far as IDC scores can go, before the LVO, which is Adepticon. So that's a nice thing to just have in your pocket right there.
It is a nice thing to have. It's a very interesting event. He also wrote a really cool article about how he prepared for the event, and freely admits that he took a list specifically for that event, as opposed to just kind of take the tried and true and, you know, do his best. So it was a really good article, and I would recommend you guys give it a read. So looking ahead to next week, it appears the only GT in town is in our town, so that means you guys need to come visit. Get to meet Don, you get to meet me, maybe even get to meet Ray. I had several players at our last tournament tell me that they don't think Ray is real. It's me talking to a voice changer. So one other event I'm just trying to figure out is, there is what's called the 40K 3rd Annual Alaska State Championship. It trying to see. It looks like it is a GT level, looking at how many registered players they have. But no, we don't live in Alaska. We live in the other climate zone, other extreme, and that is Phoenix, Arizona, because this weekend is the 2018 Scorched Earth Open. You may have heard about it once or twice here on this podcast. So I could go on for days because I've been running around like crazy as the co-tournament organizer with Don. Don, you get to play in a lot more than I do. What do you look forward to about this particular event?
So the biggest thing I'm looking forward to in this event is we are using the FAQ and all of that entails. And it'll be one of the first events that I've seen that is actually going to be doing that. So while I do hope that people watch our event, I don't think it's going to be quite as big as some of these other, like London GT and things like that. Though, I would like to see how it all tumbles out with the changes to deep striking, with the changes to the rule of three, all these things. Because this should be a completely different meta as far as tournament play goes than anywhere else so far has been. Call that ambitious, but I do believe that is the case. On top of it all, Arizona's just known for having a weird meta.
There's that, too.
There's that, too.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting weekend all around, because you mentioned the London GT. It's also this weekend, but it's for the first time in quite some time, probably 2-3 years, that the European meta is that vastly different from the American meta. And they said both metas got kind of hit with the FAQ, especially with the deep strike and the rule of three. So we're really curious to see what comes out of the woodwork, what shakes out. So I think you hit on the head. Our meta seems to be very strange and it doesn't really go along with the national trends. But I think it also goes along with who comes. I mean, one thing that's interesting about this event, we have more out-of-towners than we do locals at this particular event. But I think the local team has benefited from that and have upped their game. Second thing is the defending champ is actually going to be in London. So we will definitely have a new champion this year for the Scorched Earth Open. So be curious to see who rises to the top. And also curious to see how Mr. GM Papa does cross the pond there in London, because that's where he'll be this weekend.
Now, I'm just going to go on a limb here. I'm going to say I think Tyranny is going to pull it out. Because even though they got hit with a flyout nerf, I do believe that their codex is still the most adaptable codex that there currently is. They have everything in there, and good everything in there. So we also have a good couple, not Gene Steel players, but a good couple Tyranid players that I do think can pull it out. So I'm calling Tyranids for first place at Scorched.
Interesting. Open. How do you think Death Watch will shake out, being that they've been out for a week?
The biggest problem with that is I don't think anyone has enough models to make Death Watch appropriate yet. I'm a large fan of the idea that Intercessors are the only good option. Or I shouldn't say only good option, but they're the most cost-effective option by a massive degree in that codex. They're just, with special ammunition, I do believe that they are too cheap. They are my new Playbridge Crawler project.
They're really cool. I was, like I said before, if I was ever going to play Marines, it'd only be Death Watch, and it's very tempting to bring them back. They are, I mean, you hit it on the head, the special ammo, the upgrades, and then one thing we talked about last week is a lot of the cool tricks, which used to be war gear, are now stratagems, so you don't have to worry about, did I bring the anti-tau utility belt to the Tau game, and then you come to a tournament and you never play Tau, and you're like, oh, that was a waste of points. Now they're all stratagems. You can use them whenever you need them. It's really handy.
Yeah. And just to let you guys know how much I think the Death Watch are an extremely powerful force, I would be bringing them, but I don't have them built yet. I do honestly think that they are going to be the new powerhouse, appropriately done, to everything except for high toughness vehicle spam, which is very hard to do now. But the new meta of horde units, troop spam in general, but horde units, basically anything all that involves boots on the ground, Death Watch all have a very good answer for. and Marines in cover with their super long range of 36, 42 inches, whatever it is right now, is going to outrange, out AP, and outlive whatever they're going after, especially with all the rerolls that they are entitled to for being Death Watch. So I do think that look a month from now, I'm sure Death Watch will be doing very well, especially compared to where they have been, which is kind of cool to see where they were at the bottom. And now I do believe that they're at very close to, if not at the top, especially for all Marines. They are definitely at the top of the Marine pile.
I just think they have so many tools, and you start adding them all together and you start realizing you're rerolling to hits, wounding on twos with a reroll. And you just do the math hammer, guys. They're brutal. I think the only thing I can think of is, can they take a punch back? And that'd be the one thing. Be curious to see how they progress with that. And so we get more and more tournaments, because I think they need something to hide behind every now and then, because they just don't have enough bodies to take that much damage. I could be wrong.
They do need cover. If you're on a flat field, they're not going to have a good time. As soon as they are able to dig the boost in the cover, that 2+ save, it will shine. I promise you that.
So thinking ahead, predictions for the London GT. Who do you think was winning that?
So I will say I've definitely not been super big as far as figuring out how the European meta is. But just going based off of what I've seen, a couple weeks ago with the Almo and that other GT that were out, it's escaping my mind right now. But I do believe that Dark Elder are going to pull it off again. And they're probably going to keep doing well, just because the Rule 3 does not hurt them, generally speaking, because they already basically had it kitted into them where they were restricted. Aside from that, I do think that they have all the tools they need to, especially if they bring Eldar buddies to take care of it. If they don't bring Eldar buddies, they're still just as good. They have a whole lot of really good shooting. They are really fast. They can cover the board. They're effectively a horde army that shoots really well. So I think all that put together is going to make it so that they can outscore everyone else.
Some for a reason, I just know why it's from the European meta, but I've seen a lot of Chaos armies that are now retooling with Dreadnoughts and I can't think of the name of the Forge World Dreadnought. It's a slightly bigger one.
There's a Leviathan? The Contemptor?
No.
The Derridaeo?
Nope, not that big. It's a specific Decimator.
The Demon.
Yeah, the Demon one. I can see a lot more of those. And something that gives them longer range shooting. And they're kind of the tried and true tactics. Simply because just the type of terrain they've got in England and the type of missions they run, there's definitely a bonus to totally outscoring your opponent. I mean, it's on this differential system that the ETC uses. So plus they have the Maelstrom. But on the other hand, because of Maelstrom, they do use, you could probably see Dark Eldar do, assuming Drukhari, do very well, simply because they can, with their mobility, get to those random objectives and outscore people left and right. We'll see. Scorched Earth, I'm just thinking based off the players, thinking who's coming. And, actually, I think it's going to be a showdown locally between, because without some of the out-of-towners coming that haven't, some of the big hitters haven't been in the game in a while, so they could surprise us. But I think it's going to come down to between you and Daniel, who won Broadside Bash. I think it's going to be the showdown. Whoever wins that game is probably going to win the tournament.
And I'm sure that Daniel and I will meet. I'm hoping, the ideal finish, which is what we were sad about at Broadside. We were hoping that it would be round 5 of Broadside. It's a 5-round event there. It'll be a 6-round event at Scorched Earth. But at that 5-round event at Broadside, we met at round 4, and we're like, oh, man. This is a championship game. Unfortunately, we had to duke it out there, and Daniel was a better man at that, so he went on to go win the event. But I'm hoping that we'll meet either round 5 or round 6 at Scorched Earth and just have another good game. It's always fun playing Daniel. The best Yanari player I have played against, hands down.
So we look forward to that. In case you're wondering where I'm going to finish, this might be, well, as a TO, I usually don't get to play, but every now and then I have to swing in as a ringer, and 4 of the last 5 years, I've come in last place. So see how I do this year. So we're looking forward to seeing all of you at Scorched Earth Open. We'll have plenty of roundup of Scorched Earth as well as the London GT on next week's episode. Hopefully we'll have Ray back as well. In the meantime, Don, I want to thank you for pinch hitting tonight.
Sure thing.
And I hope you guys enjoyed the show. And this has been the Exterminatus Podcast, and we'll see you guys next week.